Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 17, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics case at the U.S. Supreme Court. My name is Christian Corrigan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Gregory Dolan, Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, for a special Courthouse Steps edition of our telephone calls. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Professor Dolan, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation. It really is a pleasure to be here and to talk about a case which is sort of near and dear to my heart. I will sort of, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll tell up front that I filed a brief in this case on the side of the respondents, Myriad Genetics, so perhaps as we get to talking about some of my predictions, they may be sort of colored by some of the rose-colored glasses and from how I would like the case to come out. So with that in mind, perhaps, you know, there's some of my opinion should be taken with a grain of salt. So, but with that disclosure, let me begin by talking about what the case was about, how it got to the Supreme Court, and then I'll talk about sort of the oral argument itself, and then as to my prediction, then we can sort of do the Q&A. Basically, and I was so lucky enough after the argument to share a panel with Chris Hansen, the counsel who argued the case for the petitioners, and so I actually have heard his exact account as to how he brought the case. But basically, ACLU was looking to litigate new issues in the area of technology and privacy, and they stumbled across an issue where they believe what they found is that patents obtained by Myriad, who are the respondents in this case, have actually are covering actual human genes in body, and that these patents create a number of problems for privacy and healthcare-related issues, and they've decided to sue pretty much whoever they could to create a precedential decision invalidating such patent and ending the ability of the Patent and Trademark Office to grant patents on DNA. And so when they went out looking both for plaintiffs and defendants, and they found a number of women who are either diagnosed with or have high risk of breast and ovarian cancer given their family history, and they looked for patent holders who hold patents on various genes, and they decided the Myriad is a perfect target because they hold a patent on what's called BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. There are genes that are particularly expressed in women with high risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And for whatever reason, ACLU thought that Myriad was a particularly bad corporate citizen, and so they picked them as a defendant. They found a number of women who wanted the testing done at a lower cost than Myriad was offering. They found a number of doctors who wanted to produce testing or conduct research claimed that they fear that they will be subject to liability for infringing Myriad's patents. They found a couple of universities, and this ultimately Association for Molecular Pathology. So that was sort of the procedural background of the case. They filed a suit in Southern District of New York where they prevailed on their argument that none of these patents are valid. Ultimately, it was taken up to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which reversed in part the Southern District of New York. AMP and their counsel, ACLU, filed a writ of certiorari petition in the Supreme Court. Supreme Court vacated and remanded to the Federal Circuit to reconsider in light of a previous opinion. The Federal Circuit reconsidered, issued pretty much the same opinion that it did before. The petitioners petitioned for a writ of certiorari again. Supreme Court granted it, and so that's how we came to the argument. So that's sort of the procedural history. Now, the issue in the case, in some ways, is very simple, but as I think I'll explain both to the call and so how the argument went developed. It turns out to be not as simple after all. But the issue is simple as framed by Association of Molecular Pathology and ACLU. Simply this, are human genes patentable? Are they patent eligible? Is that a type of invention that would even qualify for patent protection? The way I often teach patent eligibility to my students is I say that first question essentially asks, if you do an analogy to a sports event, did you show up to the right stadium? So if you show up to the basketball court wearing a helmet and shoulder pads, you're not in the right stadium. You don't get to play the game. If you show up to the right stadium, doesn't mean you actually win the game. You still need to play and you still need to score. But we will at least let you on the field and we'll let you play and see if you win. And so that's kind of how the patent system works. Section 101 asks, did you show up to the right stadium? Is what you want us to look at, is that the type of invention that is patent eligible under our laws? And then if it is, then we'll actually examine your application to see if what you've invented is sufficiently new, if it satisfies all the other requirements of the Patent Act. So the question that was litigated in this case was, is DNA, is this chemical molecule, is it patent eligible subject matter? And the answer, I think, it really depends on how you look at it. On one hand, DNA is simply a chemical molecule and has been almost a patent law truism that, of course, chemicals are patent eligible. If you've synthesized a new chemical in the laboratory, of course you can get patent protection on it. And that's, in fact, how most of our chemical drugs, you know, that a number of us take are subject to patent protection. On the other hand, and so that's the theory that ACLU at least initially pressed, is that if you look at DNA simply as a set of instructions, as information, of course, then it's not patentable. You can't patent a book. You can't patent a sort of a manual. It's not what qualifies under the Patent Act. So, but the problem is DNA is both. It's both a chemical molecule, and it is information. ACLU didn't get very far in the sort of information aspect, and so ultimately what they decided to press is this theory that a DNA is naturally occurring substance. We all carry DNA. And so the fact that Myriad found that a particular portion of DNA codes for a particular disease is not sufficiently inventive to qualify for patent protections. That essentially they relied on what is known as the product of nature doctrine. That things that you find in nature that already existed, not something that you've yourself invented, are not eligible for patent protection. So, for example, if you were the first person to find gold or diamonds or copper in Earth, as useful as that discovery may be, you don't get to patent gold. You may patent a new use for gold if you discovered it. You may patent a new method of extracting gold, but you don't get patent on gold itself. And so that was sort of their analogy. That's the analogy that the petitioners made, that extracting small piece of DNA, small genes from the overall genetic sequence is simply just like extracting gold out of a ground and purifying it, but that should not entitle Myriad or anybody else to patents on those excised pieces. Myriad, of course, took a different view. They said, up until we actually figured out where this gene starts and ends, up until we figured out what it does, this was part of a huge genomic sequence of billions of nucleotides, and was of no particular use to the public at large because they didn't know what it did. And so Myriad's analogy that they pressed, for example, in the Supreme Court was that, sure, it is extracting something smaller from something bigger, but it's much like saying that a baseball bat is a smaller piece of a tree. In some ways, it's true you have to use wood to create a baseball bat, but Myriad's argument. But you don't. That doesn't mean that a baseball bat is something naturally occurring. You must pick a tree. You must pick how to cut it. You must pick how to create a particular shape and ultimately put it to a particular use. And so that was sort of the debate. And unfortunately, that is how it was presented in the Supreme Court, with these very imperfect analogies. Obviously, the resolution of this debate has a number of implications for both science and sort of development of science, but also for patients at large. From the petitioner's point of view, invalidating these patents ultimately will be a good thing because patients will have access to cheaper testing, faster testing, instead of having just one laboratory like Myriad out there. There will be multiple laboratories being able to conduct the test. Patients will be able to get a second opinion. Competition will reduce prices, and ultimately everybody will be better off. Scientists won't fear litigation. They'll be able to more freely use these genes for future research, and so on. And so from a petitioner's point of view, invalidating these patents promotes public good because it sort of frees up this information and lowers cost of medical services. From the respondents and a number of amici, including myself, the point of view was that is true in so far, everything petitioner said is true, only to the extent that we're talking about a static market, right? So, sure, today's patients probably be better off because they'll be paying lower costs, and today's scientists will be better off because they won't have to live in fear of litigation. But inventions and sort of science is not a static market. Market progresses. Market relies on people investing in some future development and so on. And so if we invalidate these patents, if we say you cannot get patents on these types of compounds, the investment stream will, if not dry up, then it will be certainly reduced. And so the pace of future inventions will be slowed down, and the future patients will then have less to work with. So, and that is, you know, in some ways that is a constant dispute about the patent system. That is true about whether we're talking about DNA or drugs or, you know, cars or airplanes or whatever else. That is sort of the balance that the patent system attempts to strike. That on one hand we give exclusive rights to people, to inventors today at the cost of paying higher prices today, but in exchange we hope that these incentives spur innovation and so we get more things, better things, and faster things, even though if we have to for a while the patent is in force, pay more for them. And after all, patents do expire 20 years from the date of grant, or actually from the date of application. So there's a dispute about sort of how to look at it from a matter of science. There's a dispute as to what are the implications if the decision comes out one way or the other. And there's certainly a dispute about whether sort of the parade of horribles, or for that matter, you know, the promises made by the petitioners should the patent be invalidated, is true. It's noteworthy in some way that this is one of those unusual cases where it's not the patent holder that sues the alleged infringer. Usually patent cases, not always, but usually patent cases come up in a situation where a patentee sees somebody infringing their patents or about to infringe their patents, and they either sue or they threaten to sue somebody, you know, a potential or accused infringer. And so they are trying to enforce their rights. This is a case where the patentee is the one being sued by people saying that their research and their testing is being chilled. And that should give you some sort of idea that perhaps petitioners' claims that science is being really significantly chilled is not quite true, because if it were, Myriad, the respondents, would have been the ones on top. They would have been the ones suing scientists. But it seems that they haven't been enforcing their patents to a great degree against people really engaging in basic research. And in fact, so in the initial case, when it was brought in Southern District of New York, it was brought in the name of several parties, several scientists, and a number of them were held to have no standing precisely because there was no threat that Myriad would ever sue them, and so only ultimately one party out of many ended up having standing. So in any event, so this is about 15 minutes of my background, so let me move back into how the argument went. Up front, let me say that it was shocking and somewhat, I guess, disappointing to see that the Supreme Court is struggling with basic black-letter patent law. Justice Kennedy, fairly early on, asked Chris Hansen, the counsel for the petitioner, is it possible for a patent to be held valid in part, and I'm paraphrasing, but valid in part and invalid in part? Can such a thing be done? And he was incredulous that it could be. And of course it can, because patents are not a unitary document. Patents conclude with a number of claims, and there can be one claim or two claims, or some patents have a hundred or hundreds of claims. When you evaluate the patent, you evaluate it claim by claim. So claim one may very well be invalid, and claim three can be valid, and claim four may not even be in litigation, and so on. In fact, this is exactly what happened in the present case. ACLU succeeded in invalidating a number of claims below, and those invalidated claims were not appealed, and so only a few claims were at issue at the Supreme Court. So that is just a basic misunderstanding and lack of knowledge of patent law. That was somewhat of a scary moment, given the fact that the decision here was going to have significant implications on the law and as well on the economy as well. And unfortunately, on science, the justices did not much better. Most of the argument was spent discussing a number of fairly poorly crafted hypotheticals. Justice Sotomayor asked the following hypothetical. Said, well, if I invent a new chocolate chip cookie, I can maybe patent a cookie, but I surely cannot patent the ingredients, the salt and the flour and so on. Justice Roberts was particularly enamored with a baseball bat analogy. Justice Alito was talking about discovering a new plant in the Amazon and chewing bark off that plant for medicinal purposes. And, of course, courts always thrive on analogies, and that's fine, but unfortunately, none of these analogies are particularly apt to the present case. And the fact that the court felt the need to rely on them was an indication that most of the justices, although they've tried, you could see by their question that they've tried to understand the scientific issues, they really failed to grasp the import of the science and a particular breadth and scope of the claims at issue. In fact, when discussion finally turned to the difference between what's called genomic DNA, in other words, the entire genetic sequence of a particular gene, versus cDNA, which is the sequence of the gene with all the non-coding regions being excised. Since human genes have both coding and non-coding regions, cDNA is the one where the non-coded regions have been excised and sort of lab-created molecule. Justice Kennedy said, well, when I first read about cDNA and when I sort of came into the oral argument, I thought cDNA was simply what he called an economy class gene, and now I'm beginning to realize that it's not. So ultimately, the court will have to resolve this issue somewhat blind to, or with a certain lack of understanding of what the science is. But I must give them credit. They certainly tried. They tried their best. Unfortunately, I think neither counsel, Mr. Hansen arguing for the petitioners, nor Greg Castanhas arguing for the respondents, did a particularly great job trying to explain science. And perhaps it was an impossible task, but ultimately, analogies, I think, were not particularly effective. But basically, if I had to characterize sort of the tone of questions to both counsels, with respect to petitioner's counsel, Chris Hansen argued that you don't really need patent protection in this area because plenty of scientists work not so much for the financial gain from that they will expect to receive from patents, but because they have government-sponsored grants, university-sponsored grants, because they really are searching for some sort of scientific truth, because they're chasing a Nobel Prize, and so on. And he tried to push that argument fairly early on, and it was pretty quickly cut off by Justice Kennedy, who said, well, although maybe your point is true, maybe scientists do it for, the greater glory of science, but we just can't take that on faith. We can't just say that patents in this case serve no useful function and just believe that everything will be just fine economically in terms of incentives because scientists are altruistic. So I don't think Justice Kennedy was not the only one who was not buying into that argument. I think Justice Kagan was in the same boat. So I think that line of attack didn't work particularly well. So justices were clearly very concerned about the proper balancing of incentives. Justices were also fairly concerned about drawing a making sure that whatever opinion they write would not affect too much. So even if they were going to agree with the petitioners, they were very concerned not to cause too much negative impact on scientific exploration and on incentives to continue to explore in the field of biologic medicine. What's particularly interesting is that just last term, the court issued a very broad 9-0 opinion with no concurrences in judgments, no dissents, invalidating a patent on methods of treatment. So there was this patent as a case, Prometheus versus Mayo. It was a very broadly written opinion suggesting that in order to clear this 101 bar, in order to clear this first bar to getting a patent, significant amount of inventive work needs to be done. And that opinion was roundly criticized in academic writings. And what was interesting to note is that almost no one mentioned that opinion, certainly from the bench, during the entire argument. The court seemed to itself be a little bit concerned about the breadth of the opinion they just wrote just a year ago. And so the justices were seeking to step back a little bit from sort of the breadth of their previous opinion, saying that Section 101 is really a significant barrier to patent eligibility. On the other side, with respect to Greg Castanhas, who argued for the respondents, the court was really concerned about drawing a proper line. Justice Kagan really pressed Mr. Castanhas about where do we draw the line between what is naturally occurring and what is not. She asked him, well, if you can patent a whole piece of DNA, can you patent a chromosome? And Mr. Castanhas said yes. And so Justice Kagan sort of pressed her point further. What about if you cut out a liver from a body, and you're the first person to do that? Can you patent a liver? And Greg Castanhas again said yes. He made some qualifications, but he said yes. And so although he certainly was sticking to his guns because he was trying to get the court to understand that perhaps this doctrine of accepting naturally occurring products from patent eligibility has outlived its usefulness, especially when we talk about biologic medicine, it's pretty clear that that's not where the court wanted to go. And nobody, even Justice Alito, who seemed, I think, most sympathetic to the respondents, was really not buying that argument. But respondents sort of kept making it. And so he may have ultimately done more harm than good with that answer. But he certainly made a point that that in his view, the doctrine of exceptions for products of nature or natural phenomena shouldn't bar new medical advances of almost any kind. So ultimately, the court was really really trying to balance the concerns about proper incentives versus the concerns about giving scientists, giving the inventors too much patent protection for things that they themselves did not invent, but merely discovered, whether in Amazon forest or in human body. What did seem fairly clear to me is that the court did seem to understand that there may very well be a difference between genomic DNA, in other words, so again, this entire gene with both coding and non-coding regions, which is the way that they thought about it. It may not be fully scientifically accurate, but those are the way they thought about it. It's simply a piece of DNA cut out from a chromosome with no other alterations made to it, versus cDNA, which is a piece of DNA cut out from a chromosome, and then on top of that, non-coding regions excised. And so it seems that they were certainly more willing to admit that once the second modification step has occurred, that may be sufficient human intervention to allow at least the inventor to apply for a patent, whether it's would satisfy the novelty and non-obviousness requirements would remain to be seen, but not the whole genomic DNA. And so that brings me, I suppose, to my last point before I'm going to try to make some prediction and then open up the floor for questions. There were a couple of justices, specifically Justice Alito and Justice Roberts, who were openly wondering why did the petitioners bring the case on the broadest possible terms. Petitioners, again, sought to invalidate these patents on the grounds of Section 101, meaning that patents on DNA, not just the one by Myriad, but generally the DNA is simply not a patent-eligible subject matter. No matter who applies, no matter how they apply, it's simply not, we're not even going to let you play the game. And Justice Alito and Justice Roberts were openly wondering why is that petitioners did not bring a narrower claim, for example, saying that although this is patent-eligible subject matter, although the petitioners may have very well been, showed up to the right stadium, but they didn't do sufficient amount of work to make this sufficiently inventive. So it's not, it's invention, but it's not sufficiently new, given the fact that, we've been sequencing DNA for quite a while. And there was some interest, at least on part of those two justices, perhaps also Justice Scalia, to perhaps explore whether or not the proper avenue to attack these patents to the extent that people believe that they're a problem are obviousness considerations. Of course, when we talk about obviousness, it's more of patent by patent as opposed to just generally saying that DNA is not patent-eligible subject matter. So that was, and in fact, so that is a position that I've outlined in my brief as well, saying that this is something, perhaps a more fruitful avenue to look. I've expressed no opinion whether these particular patents are obvious, but I thought that to the extent that people are concerned, perhaps obviousness consideration is the one where people should be looking at. So with that, I guess let me turn to what I think the court will do. It seems to me that, again, so respondents did themselves no favors refusing to draw any lines in what is and what is not patent-eligible subject matter. I think there may have been a line to draw between livers and chromosomes and genomic DNA. Whether the court would have bought it is a separate issue, but I think there was a line. And so refusing to draw the line, I think, led justices to believe that, no such lines exist, and so genomic DNA must fall together with isolated liver or isolated chromosome or isolated kidney. So I think that patents on genomic DNA, the court probably is going to say that genomic DNA is not patent-eligible subject matter, that there is not enough inventiveness in simply taking a piece of a chromosome, cutting it out, and identifying it as a gene for that codes for breast cancer or for other disease or for particular beneficial characteristics or whatever else. On the other hand, there was, I counted at least four justices. And Justice Thomas, as his custom, he didn't say anything. But I count at least four justices: Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy, and who am I missing? Roberts, Alito, Justice Scalia, suggesting that at least cDNA should be patent eligible because otherwise it might undercut too much of incentives to innovate. I think Justice Breyer was sort of the more skeptical justice on that. But I think cDNA, whether it's going to be unanimous or some split decision, I think cDNA will survive in terms of patent eligibility, which I think in some ways is probably not a terrible position. In fact, that is the position, so this is one argument that I have omitted thus far. It is exactly the position advocated by the Solicitor General's office by Solicitor General Verrilli, who argued the case. He said, let's draw the line between genomic DNA, which is simply cutting a piece out of a chromosome, and cDNA, which is involves more manipulation. And the court seems to be interested in going in that direction. My major sort of concern is how broadly or narrowly the opinion will be written, but also how clearly or how murky the opinion will be written, because the Supreme Court has had several cases before it on patent law in the last few years, and oftentimes have written opinions that are just not clear and sort of created more questions than it actually answered. And so on that, I think ultimately where that sort of the fight between the justice, to the extent there is any, will be, as to how broadly to write it, but also how narrowly to write it. But ultimately, if they invalidate genomic DNA, that's probably not a huge deal because, I mean, what has to be remembered is Myriad's patents are quite old. In fact, they're expiring in about a year or two. I believe actually in about late 2014 they're expiring. So since Myriad applied for their patents, the entire human genome has been sequenced. So we actually know what the unmodified sequences are, and so they're even if modified sequences were patent eligible, they probably would be obvious given the fact that we have completed the human genome project. We haven't figured out what each gene codes for, but we've figured out what this actual sequence is. So if they invalidate it, probably not a big loss almost to anyone, provided that the opinion is written in a sufficiently clear and narrow fashion. If I'm wrong and so the court invalidates everything, then I think a number of other problems may arise. So let me just end there and open up the floor for questions. And to the extent that I was unclear, I'm certainly happy to clarify either the law or the science or sort of how the argument went.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor Dolan. I will now open the floor to the questions from our callers. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We'll begin answering questions in the order which they were received. And we will go now to our first question.
John Roland, Constitution.org. It would seem that the jurisprudence in this area might be better served if we did a little anticipation for where technology is going to take us. And we're very close to being able to get gene editors that can not only read a single gene, but edit it on the fly and reinsert it in a cell within a matter of minutes. So at this point, these nucleotide sequences become just letters of a alphabet, and the whole, either the genome or any part of it, is just a form of expression, not really patentable, but maybe copyrightable. But if it's not, if it's something that could occur in nature, you know, if letters of a message could rearrange themselves into a work of Shakespeare on their own, then you wouldn't be able to copyright that. Everything depends on the unlikelihood of that particular configuration occurring in nature.
Right. So I guess I agree with sort of the first part of your question, that we certainly should, or hopefully the court does take into consideration when writing its opinion where technology is going, because ultimately, patent law, by its nature, is written not for old technology, but for the new one, for the one that's unanticipated. You know, things that are anticipated are not interesting in terms of, they're not inventive. They actually rarely get patent protection. We're trying to look at the new areas, and that's why it's so hard to write patent law, because, you know, when Congress, we're still operating under 1952 Patent Act, granted as amended, but still, the overall structure is 1952 Patent Act. Watson and Crick did not publish their paper about the DNA structure until 1953. So Congress could have had no inkling and no idea whether or not DNA would be or would not be covered under the Patent Act. That's why they wrote it broadly to cover all sorts of technologies. And so I agree, we certainly have to look ahead, and that's why I hope when this court writes its opinion, they will take that into account and avoid making overly sweeping statements while the statement that they make, keeping them clear. In fact, again, so I was on a panel on Monday right after the argument where we were discussing just that. Just a couple days ago, there was an article, I believe, in New York Times that scientists have created a first artificial or lab-grown kidney that functions like a real kidney that actually produces urine and perhaps could be used, at least in mice, and could be used in the future, the science could be used in the future to move people in end-stage renal disease and renal failure from dialysis machines to these lab-produced kidneys. And so that's where we're that's where we're going. We're looking, science is moving away from treating diseases by chemicals and trying to treat them by biologic materials. And so the concern is that the court, it's not just about DNA, it's about this idea is whether or not we will allow protection for things that look like naturally occurring counterparts. And I think that to deny the protection would essentially say that chemical treatments, the ones that we're used to now, are preferential to better and sort of more advanced biologic treatment, because chemicals look nothing like what's in the nature, while biologic treatments, the whole point is to make them as close as to what's naturally occurring, and yet we will sort of deny patent protection to them. And I think that's sort of odd to me. Of course, you know, as Judge Giles Rich, who was a preeminent judge in the Federal Circuit and one of the drafters of the 1952 Patent Act, said, of course, in the patent law, the name of the game is the claim. And so, of course, if you draw claims broadly enough to encompass naturally occurring products and not just lab-produced products, even though they look the same, of course that shouldn't be valid. That's always been true. But, again, sort of a broad statement that that lab-created products, whether they're proteins or kidneys or whatever else, should be invalid simply because they look and function like naturally occurring products in vivo, I think that will wreak havoc in biologic industry.
And our lines are open now, so again, if you have a question, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. That's star and then the pound key. A quick programming note, make sure and join us tomorrow for our next scheduled Teleform conference call, Thursday, April 18th at 12 p.m. Eastern, which is an update on the HHS contraception mandate litigation with Professor Mark Rienzi from Catholic University School of Law and Bill Saunders from Americans United for Life. We also have another one on Friday, which is sponsored by the Intellectual Property Practice Group, on what's next for copyright enforcement, rogue sites, and other challenges. And we have our next caller.
Hi, it's Andy Schlafly. I'm an attorney who works in this area sometimes, and I filed an amicus brief in this case. And I'm wondering if Professor Dolan could comment on why the Supreme Court is taking so many patent cases. And it seems to me that there's a kind of a new war against patents. And the breadth of this case, the way that the issue was framed so broadly, is there a movement to try to eliminate patent law or sharply narrow it? I know there are a number of libertarians who are now speaking out against patents as a general matter. And what, so if the professor could comment on that, why are there so many patent cases, and is there a movement to sharply narrow patents for everything?
Sure, I'll be happy to. In fact, so I do have some perspective. Before taking my current job, I was a clerk on the Federal Circuit, so I got to see it kind of from the other side as well. I think there's several explanations. I think one is that Supreme Court kind of let the Federal Circuit alone for, by and large, for about almost 30 years, between 1984 when Federal Circuit was created, or 82 when the Federal Circuit was created, and about first decade of 2000. So they started sort of picking up patent cases in about 2005, 2006. And so the the answer to that is, you know, they gave Federal Circuit some room to develop its own doctrine, develop its own law, and but so the side effect of that was that in some areas the Federal Circuit has perhaps gone too far, and in fact there are some complaints. I'm not going to opine whether they're fair complaints or not, but there are some complaints that the Federal Circuit has gone too far, essentially been captured by the industry, has become too patent-friendly of a court, and the Supreme Court needs to step in to make the correction. Part of the problem is that it's one of those inevitable problems that when you have a specialized court, that unlike the regional circuits, there's no competition there. There are no circuit splits. Federal Circuit is the only court that does patent law. By and large, there's some small exceptions, but by and large, they're the only court that does patent law. And so there's no conversation really happening between the Federal Circuit and some other circuit, as, for example, does happen in, say, criminal law or somewhere else, between regional circuits about what the right application is. So there's little authority, or there's little persuasive authority to draw for the Federal Circuit to draw on, and as a result, they don't get to have this judicial conversation, and they perhaps their opinions get skewed, I don't want to characterize whether fairly or unfairly, but there's whether the perception is fair or unfair, but there's been some perception that the Federal Circuit, even after Supreme Court has taken some of the case and reversed them, so that the Federal Circuit simply ignores the Supreme Court and sort of continues to do what it does. Again, I'm not sure that all of that is fair, but you know, there's certainly that perception among some in the bar and some sort of in the industry. In fact, sort of, there's been a number of blog posts saying Federal Circuit again overruled Supreme Court. Obviously, not in a real sense, but pretty much saying, acknowledging Supreme Court's opinion, but continue to do what they've done before. So perhaps that also is the reason for the Supreme Court to, for the renewed interest. In terms of politics, whether or not there's, Supreme Court is affected by libertarian or other views, that I don't know. Obviously, for example, in this case, there's been a significant change in the position of the executive branch up until this administration, in this case, the view of the executive branch was that, of course, DNA is patentable. We've been issuing patents for 30 years. Patent Office has been doing it. We have guidelines. And, of course, there are patent-eligible subject matter. This administration changed the view in a somewhat bizarre fashion, too. They took the view that some DNA is patentable, such as cDNA, while genomic DNA is not patent-eligible subject matter. And that's the view they presented to the Federal Circuit for the first time ever, that the Solicitor General himself argued a case in the Federal Circuit, and that's the view they presented in the Supreme Court. What's odd about the administration's position is that while the Department of Justice is taking this view that only some DNA is patent eligible, the Patent Office, also an executive branch agency, continues to issue patents on as it did before the DOJ switched its position. So the executive branch is being a little schizophrenic here as well. Again, I don't want to say this has happened because the previous administration was Republican and conservative and this is Democratic and liberal. That's, I don't know the politics behind it. But there certainly has been this shift. So I think that's why the Supreme Court has taken more cases. One is that it's to figure out it's time to sort of to perhaps have some corrective course that the Federal Circuit was not able to do itself because of lack of competition for judicial pronouncements that's present in the regional circuits. And two, that the administration, the executive branch, has started to urge you to take more cases. It did it with Bilski, it did it with Myriad. And I would say that Supreme Court, there's certainly some anti-patent elements, and again, I don't want to say whether that's good or bad, but there's certainly people on the court who view patent system as presently constituted as skeptical. I think Justice Breyer is a leader of that wing of the court. Whether he's right or wrong, I mean, I think that probably I disagree with some of his opinions, especially one in Mayer versus Prometheus, but there is this view on the Supreme Court, I think, that patent system has started protecting too much, and there's a time for correction.
This is Christian Corrigan again. Our lines are open, so if you have any remaining questions for Professor Dolan, enter star and then the pound key. We do have two more questions on the line now.
Yeah, I noticed that upon looking at the claims, they're all directed to the DNA sequence. None of them seem to be, or none that I noticed, were directed to a method of diagnosing an illness using this DNA gene sequence. Is there any significance to that?
Yeah, I guess yes and no. So the initial, when the case was initially brought in the Southern District of New York, those claims were also issued. Marriott does have or did have claims that were directed towards diagnosing. Unfortunately for Marriott, the claims were written in fairly abstract manner. Essentially, I don't have claims in front of me now, but basically the claim said, collect a sample of DNA from a patient, compare it to the sample of DNA that we have on file, and give the patient the result. So in a very sort of broad and abstract fashion. And so following Prometheus, those were invalidated, and so the appeal was not taken up on those claims.
Okay, and they were invalidated because it was just a thought process. There was no mechanism disclosed.
Right. That said, at the Supreme Court argument, the justice asked and the counsel for the petitioner conceded that to the extent somebody figures out a new use for a gene, whether it's a diagnosing or something else, provided that it's more than just a thought process, that even under the petitioner's view of what the patent law should be and how far the product of nature should extend, that a new use for DNA, a new use for genes, a new use for cDNA should in fact be patent eligible subject matter. So, but it has to be written in such a way as to not be more than just a thought process.
However, whenever you're doing the diagnosing or the examining of the gene, you have to use some mechanism to extract and decode the gene, and then some other mechanism to compare it to a database. And so there are mechanical processes involved necessarily. It's not just that you look at somebody and say, oh, you've got this gene. You can't just do that. You've got to use some machinery there.
Absolutely.
And to make an enabling disclosure, they would have had to describe at least one instance of using that machinery, and by using a means claim, they might have been able to narrow it to that specific disclosure.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason those claims were invalid is, again, because they were written very broadly. They didn't include, in the claims themselves, did not include any sort of recitation of machines, or to the extent that they did was sort of viewed as insignificant post-solution activity. Again, remember that Marriott's claims are old claims. Their patent is, let's see, if they expires in 2014, minus 17 years, so that's, it's pre-turn of the century. So this is before Bilski was decided, this is before Prometheus was decided, so at that time, drafting a claim such as look and compare was considered to be acceptable, and so that's what they did, and you can hardly fault them for it. But at the same time, the court had to work with the claims as written and not as they would have been written had patent counsel for Marriott known of the upcoming decisions 15 years down the line. So, again, because everybody seems to agree that you could patent a way of diagnosing, you could patent a way of use, provided you draft a claim with appropriate, given due regard to Bilski and to Prometheus, that's fine. It's just that Marriott, because they patented long before those opinions came down, just was not in compliance with the law as stated by the Supreme Court in Prometheus and Marriott. I mean, Bilski.
And then given that these are known technologies, it seems hard to envision a claim where you describe these technologies. It makes it very difficult to patent anything by simply comparing the gene to its instance of a correspondence to a disease. It may make those method claims unpatentable as well.
And I think that's right. And again, I think that's what sort of the court was struggling with, especially again in light of Prometheus. That's why I said no justice pretty much even mentioned Prometheus. I think it was the Solicitor General who kind of implied that, look, you're saying all these nice things now, but we're sort of constrained by your own opinion of just a year ago in arguing justice, because you told us that this is what sort of, that's what sort of the law of the land is. So whether or not these methods, you know, although everybody agrees they're patent eligible, if you combine Prometheus with whatever opinion is going to come down here, it very well may be that it's going to be very hard to patent both genetic material as such and methods of using it. But I think ultimately everything will depend, A, on the scope and breadth and the clarity of the opinion in this case, and also ultimately how the Federal Circuit will apply, Federal Circuit and District Court judge will apply Prometheus. Because, again, at least it seemed from the argument, it's obviously very dangerous to draw conclusions from the argument, but it seemed from the argument that the Supreme Court perhaps itself is not particularly happy about the breadth of Prometheus' opinion that they wrote just a year ago.
This is Christian again. I think we have two more questions on the line, so we'll try to get to those, both of those questions, before the end of the call. So, callers, if you will try to keep your questions brief, and hopefully we can get to both before the end of the call.
Hi, this is Gary Wheaton. I'm a student at Massachusetts School of Law. And so a quick question is if the professor could just let us know what he might think, assuming that the Supreme Court does rule against Myriad and makes it harder to patent genes, and if the professor could wave a magic wand, what would he do to incentivize private industry?
Well, it's funny that you should ask, because I actually have an article coming out just on that point. It's coming out in Iowa Law Review in about a month or so. And so I would direct you to that. It's, I believe, volume 98 of Iowa Law Review. It should be online pretty much within a week or two, maybe a month or so, but not more than that. But basically, I think if the Supreme Court were to rule fully against Myriad and say that genetic materials are not patent eligible, there's two ways to respond. One, obviously, Congress can overrule this decision by statute. Congress can explicitly say, no, when we say manufacturer, we also mean genetic materials. Although a fight might ensue as to whether Congress can constitutionally do it, because Supreme Court has intimated in previous opinions that there is a constitutional minimum that Congress must leave to the public, that Congress actually is not constitutionally permitted, for example, to let the first discoverer of gold or some new sort of mineral patent it, because the patent clause in the Constitution is not meant to give protection to people who just sort of merely discover laws of nature. That seems to be a constitutional minimum. But the other way, so what I suggested in my article was that ultimately, when we're talking about medical devices and medical treatments and so on, ultimately, of course, patent is important, and patent sort of is what protects you. But the money, really, you start making the money is not when you get a patent. You start making the money when you get an approval to go on the market from the FDA. And so what Congress can do is Congress can provide individuals who not just merely discover genes, but actually convert them to something useful, such as developing a new test for genetic disease, developing a new way to treat a genetic disease, or whatever else, giving them regulatory exclusivity, essentially saying to the FDA, the first person to come up with a new breast cancer test, he will get 3, 5, whatever balance Congress should strike, 3, 5, 10 years of regulatory exclusivity, during which point FDA will not approve similar or identical tests. If somebody comes up with alternative tests that does something different, even though it tests for the same disease, sure, and we can have competition. But as a matter of regulatory approval, FDA will not give approval for a number of years to copycats. And so that may be a way to get around the patent protection. And that way, actually, it will alleviate fears of scientists who would just want to merely work and research on the gene, because FDA protection will simply extend to what you can sell on the market and not necessarily what you can do in the laboratory, while at the same time giving sufficient incentives to bring new products to market. Now, whether Congress will actually take me up on my advice, given congressional gridlock, I doubt it, but I think that may be a way to solve regulatory exclusivity, maybe a way to solve the patent problem.
Great. Well, it looks like we do have time to get to our last question, so caller, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Professor Dolan, this is John Witherspoon. I'm a patent attorney in Washington. And
John?
In your discussion of the method claims a minute ago, I did not hear you distinguish between the types of method claims. The Federal Circuit singled out method claim 20, which was to a method of screening potential cancer therapies, and said that was patentable under 101, but the other method claims, analyzing or comparing the sequences, was not.
Right.
Did claim 20 get discussed before the Supreme Court?
No.
And what is your view as to what they might do with that?
It wasn't discussed. I actually, again, so I don't have the claim 20 or Federal Circuit decision right in front of me. I can certainly look it up. Supreme Court purposefully granted search on just one issue, whether or not human genes are patentable. I think my overall guess is they're not necessarily going to get into great details about Myriad's own claims. There was some discussion that Shigan showed that justices don't quite understand patent law or science, because some of the Myriad's substance claims, not method claim, but the manufacturer claims, claim shorter sequence of DNA of 15 nucleotides each, and some justices seem to be concerned that that's sort of too little, and so that reads on a lot of what occurs in nature. So ultimately, Myriad's claim might fall because of the way they are written. While even if the Supreme Court does choose to preserve patents and genes overall, but my point is this: that I don't think that justice will get into great detail discussing Myriad's claims itself. I think they're going to be making sort of grander statements about the law and genes and sort of genetic materials and patents. To the extent that Claim 20 is more than just a just a thought process.
It's
method of use. I think, to the extent it's properly written, and again, I haven't sort of spent much time analyzing that particular claim, and to the extent the court decides to actually talk about case claim by claim, which I doubt they will, but even if they do, I think that certainly will survive, because it seems that everyone was in agreement, justices, respondents, and the petitioners, and the attorney, and the solicitor general, that new methods of using naturally occurring products, assuming sort of genes, that's what genes are eligible for patent protection. Whether they may be obvious or not, that's a separate issue, but they clear the 101 bar.
Right. That's what seem to talk about method of use versus the thing itself.
I think that survives.
That runs right to claim 20, really, even though they may not identify claim 20 in their discussion.
Right. But I think to the extent they will talk about claim 20, claim 20 would survive.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Well, Professor Dolan, we really appreciate you joining us on this call. Why don't you take a minute or so to give us some concluding thoughts before we adjourn?
Sure. And again, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, and I certainly enjoyed being at the oral argument, sort of courtesy of the Federal Society, so that to enable me to do this call. Ultimately, I think I will end kind of where I started. I think that the court is really torn. I think they understand the value of patents to innovation. I think they understand that although some scientists may work, again, for just to get to the right answer, many work for financial reward, because scientists are human, and that's sort of what drives a lot of humans. At the same time, they are very concerned about overprotecting. I think so. That concern is very well expressed in Justice Breyer's dissent from dismissal of cert in LabCorp. And so they're looking where to strike that balance. And my concern is that however they strike it, in some ways, a broadly written but clear decision is better, even though sort of wrong, and so will create a number of problems. In some ways, that's better than a narrowly written murky decision, because creating a level of uncertainty without clearly explaining as to why certain things fall on one side of patentability line and the other things on the other side of the line will really create significant problems that the bar, the judges, and ultimately the investors and the scientists will have to deal with. So my hope is that they will, whatever they decide, that they will at least give the public clear indication as to how to apply the opinion that is they will hand down by July 1st.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Professor Dolan, and thank you also to our audience for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And don't forget to join us tomorrow at 12 p.m. for our call on the HHS contraception mandate litigation. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.